Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, I am joined by Marty Schwimmer and Emery Roan. We're going to talk about the election and the campaigns, false advertising, and getting to the truth. Being an active and informed listener with all of your internet and other media tools at your disposal, whether there is a truth that you can get to or not, we're going to explore that at some length. Also talk about whether Stephen Colbert can have a parody of a satire and what Comedy Central might have to say about all that next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Law, with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes, episode 354, recorded July 29th, 2016. If that was spaghetti, you'd be in jail. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. Welcome back to This Week in Law. We're so glad you could join us this week. We have one of our favorite recurring guests coming back to the show. Welcome back to the show, Marty Schwimmer. Hello, Marty.
Hello, Denise.
Great to see you, Marty. For anyone who's not already familiar with him, his partner at Leeson Ellis in New York, in White Plains, New York, as we were discussing before the show.
Right.
And he writes one of the longest running legal blogs out there, the trademark blog, and trademark and other IP issues, to be sure. But certainly trademark is definitely your cup of tea, Marty. Is that fair to say?
My wheelhouse.
Your wheelhouse, for sure. Yes. So we're going to talk about some things related to, guess what? We just wrapped up the two political conventions, and the spin is on online about what happened in those conventions, and obviously has been throughout the campaign. So we're going to talk about some things related to online discourse and campaigns and finding the truth today, being truthy, as Colbert would say. We're also going to talk about Colbert, coincidentally enough. But not before I reintroduce you, of course, to my co-host, Emery Roan. Hi, Emery.
Hey, Denise. Hey, Chad. Hey, listeners. As always, it is a pleasure to be here. I'm excited to talk through these issues. Glad to have Marty on the show.
Wonderful to see you again. Emery is a law student at California Western School of Law in San Diego. And we should disclose, I guess, right here at the top of the show before we jump into this. First of all, I should disclose that my other co-host, Mike Keyes, is not with us. As you can see, he just simply isn't hiding under the books on my desk or anything. He's not with us this week. I had to beg off for some work-related issues, but he will be back next week. So for all of you Mike fans, and you are legion, I know, stay tuned. He'll be back next week. But we should disclose, since we're going to talk about some political stuff today, I want to do it in an even-handed, fair and balanced way, not to adopt anybody's particular tagline or trademark, Marty. just let you guys know kind of where we stand personally, so you know our biases going in, and let you know that I miss Evan Brown, who was always our sort of voice of the reasonable right on the show. Now, a lot of listeners would write to me and say, Evan's not reasonable, right? He's out there. And sometimes you guys write to me and say, you're out there too on your side of the political spectrum. But I tend to skew pretty left and sort of libertarian left. And I really don't, I think terminology in this election has been really interesting too. The word progressive has sort of made it into our political discourse. And I have longtime friends online who are informing me that if you look that up on Wikipedia, you can see where that comes from and how it has evolved and become the term that we're using in the campaign this year. It came out of Chelsea Clinton's mouth last night without anybody really explaining what she meant. It's been a demarcation between Hillary and Bernie Sanders throughout the campaign. And I was sort of grumping at Jeff Jarvis on something he posted on Facebook about why are we always talking about progressive this year. I don't really understand why it's here, or what it means, and why, if it's a rebranding effort, I don't feel like it's worked. I don't feel like people on the right have any greater love for things progressive than they had for things liberal. So there's my two cents on that. But I guess that my point in bringing that up is I don't know how to classify myself politically these days. I know I skew pretty left. The libertarian stuff oftentimes can resonate with me. I have a hard time grappling with, and I think Emery's probably in the same boat too, and many people in the United States right now, grappling with the political choices that we have this year. I have people on the show, have had people on the show over the show's history, who would be far better candidates for president, I think, than many of the people who have run this year. So I think that pretty much puts my biases on the table. Emery, you want to take a shot at it too?
Yeah, you know, I think that I'm much of the same boat. You know, listeners to the show have heard me refer to this as Trainwreck 2016, so I think that pretty clearly illustrates my feelings on the matter. I really want to appear as unbiased as possible. You know, feel free to call me out in the chat if you think that I'm saying something out of line, but I really, you know, I agree with you. I'd like to disclose that up front. I usually lean left, and, you know, I might be an independent after this year. Who knows?
And Marty, take a stab at letting folks know where you stand politically.
So you've raised a profound and disturbing question that I wasn't prepared for, Denise.
Sorry, it's profound and disturbing. I know it's a little. You have to look deep inside, and I don't think you know, we need to nail things down with too much detail on that front. And I think it actually goes to a lot of what we're going to talk about on the show today. That people try and determine what's true, and what's true for you comes from what information you consume. And a lot of what we consume comes from our various online sources, and those sources have their own biases, whether they're disclosed or not. Your best. So Barney, take a stab at it.
If I could vote for anyone, it would be for Michael Bloomberg. Right. I mean, that's who I'd want to be president. And that has as much to do with competency. In other words, a average plan well executed is better than a perfect plan next week. So, I mean, at this point in my life, I'm somewhat pragmatic. I think that what's going on this year, I find myself needing to go back. Jeffersonian ideals, Madisonian respect for the structure of the country. And also, I am an unfair competition lawyer by trade, so I don't like unfair competition. To the extent that my bias is going to affect what you hear me say today, that's where my bias is coming from.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so with those cards on the table and the further just sort of philosophical note out there that one of the reasons that I've always loved doing this show, and I'm so blessed and fortunate and enjoy doing this show, is I feel like there are so few opportunities for people to have relatively unedited, lengthy periods of time to go deep on issues. And I feel like in order to get to a understanding or the beginnings of an understanding, you really need that. You need not just people speaking in sound bites, but people trying to wrap their heads around things in a thoughtful way. If that's a political bias, then I have that too. Go ahead, Marty.
I noticed that someone on IRC said, "So glad I missed the conventions." And yeah. I certainly do understand the sentiment, because it's very easy to adopt an escapist view about what we've been exposed to this year. But I think what you said is very profound. And I thought that watching both conventions, if for no other reason than we weren't exposed to the short attention span that we normally have when ingesting media, that that alone was worth it. I'll leave it at that. If you guys have missed the conventions, go back and see the important speeches for both parties.
Yeah, I would echo that. I didn't watch all of the important speeches for both parties, but the ones that I watched, I wound up being glad that I did. And agree with you, Marty, that they did give people time to stretch. And in some instances, that that seemed long. And like, really, I'm going to watch another hour of this, but okay. But it is, you know, what we're talking about. The fact that the networks would actually give over that time to allow people to say their pieces and anecdotes to come out that, you know, you might not otherwise see. Okay, so with all of that preamble, let's talk about some legislation, regulation, and policy and false advertising in connection with the campaigns that we've been watching unfold. This was a pet topic that Marty has been sending me emails about throughout the campaign. And right now, after the convention, seems like a really nice time to delve into it. For those of you who aren't lawyers, and I know that there are many of you who are not, and for those of you who are lawyers who just don't practice in this area at all, I think we're going to start out by explaining or reminding you how false advertising law works. So Marty, take it away.
Okay. So an interesting question is, how do we regulate speech? We know that there's the First Amendment, and sometimes people sort of misstate that there's this absolute right to say anything you want. And the reality is that there are many regimes that kind of regulate what we can say. Fraud. You're not allowed to lie in commerce. States have little FTC acts, and then there's the big FTC, which protects the consumers against deceptive speech. At the national level, the Lanham Act, and maybe we can put that slide up, the elements of false advertising that we see in the Lanham Act. So this is Section 43A1B. Of the Lanham Act, and it asks the question, what is false advertising? So it's going to be a false or misleading statement of fact in a commercial advertisement. So there's a lot of discussion as to whether something is a commercial advertisement or not. Did the statement deceive, or it had the capacity to deceive? Talk about materiality. That's very important. I mean, is it a lie about something that doesn't matter? Was it, there's an interstate commerce requirement, and then there's an injury requirement. And a very like textbook case is, I say that this is 100% pomegranate juice, and then my competitor goes and sends it to a lab, and it is diluted with a cheaper type of thing. So it's a false statement of fact in a commercial advertisement. Someone might buy the pomegranate juice by mistake. Or not by mistake, but that they were deceived into buying it. An important characteristic that is of the statement is something called puffery. Okay, so this is an example of the sort of thing that we are exposed to. A competitor of Papa John's sued them, saying it doesn't have better ingredients. It's not a better pizza. And the analysis of this sort of claim is, no one takes this seriously. Can we roll the other one, which is the Mueller's America's... all right. America's favorite pasta. Do you guys think that this is, in fact, America's favorite pasta? It is fairly unmeasurable, not falsifiable. And the legal analysis of this is... We're not even going to get into that whole five-step analysis. We can rule, and courts sometimes dismiss this kind of claim at 12b6, at the very first instance, that the courts are capable of looking at this sort of claim and say, give me a break. no one's going to rely on this and be deceived, that they buy this and they go, this wasn't America's favorite pasta.
Let me see if I can distill that down into a principle that courts use and follow, and that is that puffery is okay. That that courts believe that we have this sort of tacit agreement between consumers and sellers in this country, where sellers can say things like America's favorite pasta, and courts go ahead and assume that people don't believe that, that they take it as, oh, they're saying they have very nice pasta and that perhaps it's America's favorite, but there's no way of demonstrating that and no one would take it seriously.
Absolutely. So much so that a judge will dismiss a claim at 12b6. And the significance to me is that it means they're making this cognitive psychological assumption without evidence. Very often, false advertising cases, you go get a survey expert, they go do focus groups, they do surveys, and they ask people, how did you interpret this statement? But when they get a claim like this, America's favorite pasta, they go, no one pays attention to that. You know, there was a case in New York. I mean, you may be disturbed by this concept that we accept this level of meaninglessness in our commercial speech. Coke and Pepsi, as a hobby, they like to sue each other for false advertising. So there was a suit here in New York, Powerade v. Gatorade. And, you know, the actual claims went off on whether this chemical in Gatorade gets absorbed 17 times faster and so on. That was the, you know, real core. That's the kind of stuff where you have to get the experts in. And if it turns out that it's only 15 times faster, okay, that's false advertising. The paradox being that I don't think people really listen so much to whether it's 17 times faster, 15. The commercial in question had someone, famous basketball player, drinks the sports energy drink, and then they jump supremely high. So the judge dismissed out of hand that claim, saying no one believes that you could drink Gatorade and suddenly become a better basketball player. And I was fairly annoyed when I read that decision, thinking this guy doesn't have teenage boys.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that the whole point of this ad is to make them buy the drink because they exactly think that drinking it will make them a better basketball player. So we tolerate a lot of inaccurate, non-falsifiable claims.
But when you get into I need you to now go to explain. So you're talking about especially food products, things we're going to eat. It seems like if you get into something as specific as something is absorbed this fast into your body, or moving away from food products into elections, when you're, you know, the electoral realm is regulated so tightly what you can and cannot say, I'm sure at some point there comes a time when you can't just say that very detailed and checkable thing I just asserted is it's puffery and we're going to not do anything about it.
So a lot of political speech involves non-falsifiable claims. Mm-hmm. Sometimes politicians, that leads into some of the stuff I brought. Politicians will stay away from falsifiable claims if there's possible to be falsified. And it's really difficult to falsify certain claims. How about we look at the Ted Cruz ad right now? Can we do that?
Sure. I think Victor's got that queued up. Now, what you told us before the show is there's a claim here that he makes.
About 5 seconds.
Take our jobs. Who's looking out for us? The truck drivers and the steel workers and the mechanics who've seen their wages not grow while the cost of living goes up. As president, I will repeal Obamacare.
There you go.
I'll pull back the regulators.
All right.
So we've got truck drivers, steel workers, and mechanics seeing their wages not grow.
While the price of living is going up. How specific is that claim? What I mean, can you prove that claim false? All right.
Be tough.
Truck drivers, I mean, so no one really keeps track on this. Let's go. Do you have a slide that talks about inflation rates?
I know that Victor while does.
While he's putting it up, close your eyes, audience. What do you think the inflation rate was over the last calendar year?
Just now over the last year.
Mm-hmm.
Small. 0.5%.
All right. So put the graph back up. So for one thing, there are many different inflation rates. This is the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and you see is negative 0.1. On the other hand, over the past, let's say the 8 years, you see that it's been as high as 3%. Social Security uses a cost of living number, the consumer price index, in order to determine whether Social Security rates should be increased or not, Social Security payments. The most recent period that they used, which is third quarter 2014 to third quarter 2015, is zero. I was shocked. I didn't know that. I looked it up yesterday in preparation here. I didn't know it was zero.
Mm-hmm.
Cruz makes a claim that one more point. There's a slide on wage rates. Can we look at that? All right. Very interesting website. The Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta tells you how wages are going. There's multiple lines because you can have an overall thing. They break it down, male, female, services, college degree. They all kind of track each other. The most granular this graph gets is male. And maybe other sites I could possibly find, like non-college degree. To me, that's what is meant by truckers and mechanics and steelworkers. However, you'll notice that the lowest line here is 1. So already this is a problematic chart. Bar graphs and other graphs should begin at 0. But in any event, it's always above 0. There's always wage growth. Is Ted Cruz's statement false? What period of time was he talking about? Which wages was he talking about? Which inflation rate was he talking about? What was the overall meaning of the claim? That people are becoming worse off because their wages are not keeping up with inflation. I don't have an answer. What is your visceral reaction to whether this is a false claim? Is it misleading?
So yeah. We've been talking about this in a we opened this with a trademark discussion, and you think that that's normally like an FTC issue. When we're talking about elections and, you know, false statements from candidates, it's an FEC issue, right? Is there I don't know this. Could you expand on that sort of distinction? And I mean, are these supposed to be even talked about in the same conversation?
So, there is a huge spectrum of political statements, and there are various regimes that regulate them. So, the FEC, the Federal Electioneering Commission, will regulate the donations and what you're allowed to say with regards to donations and how donations are made and what the politician is allowed to do with donations. And I don't see a huge speech regime about what can be done. The show notes show a movement towards using the Lanham Act in regulating to a certain extent the way entities are asking for money. So the show notes have the article from The Hill. And that talks about maybe the Lanham Act is going to be a useful vehicle. I was An interesting point. Right, that's it. Interestingly, the Lanham Act does not have a public right of action. If a donor was, in their view, defrauded by someone asking for donation, they would not have a false advertising Lanham Act cause of action. Similarly, if a person bought pomegranate juice that was watered down, they would not have a cause of action. The Lanham Act is for competitors and some closely related entities. Maybe there needs to be a super PAC that's called the Anti-False Advertising Super PAC, and they would have standing, perhaps, to go after some of these PACs. So the Lanham Act is going to regulate competitor-to-competitor false statements. The FEC is going to protect, perhaps, in the ways in which certain donation appeals. I'm kind of just bringing up as a, I mean, sort of the reason why I approached Denise to have this conversation is that there's this blind, because of the First Amendment, we have chosen a situation where politicians speak to us in a very hard to police way. We have developed policing mechanisms to try to regulate or at least improve the accuracy of speech. And it's better than nothing. Do you want to roll the – ah, there we go. Let's do the Fox News ad as an example of –
Actually, Marty, let's do that in just a second. We're having some trouble with your audio dropping out. So the studio is going to call you back. And while they do that, I'm going to give you our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases into the show in case you are a lawyer or other professional and you're listening to the show for professional credit in your field. We've got more information for you about that at wiki.twit.tv. You can find our show page there. This Week in Law is what you are listening to at the moment with Marty Schwimmer, Emery Roan, and me. I'm Denise Howell. And we have some information there for lawyers in particular in the United States, places where you can submit in your jurisdiction to get MCLE credit for listening to or watching the show. And we put these phrases in so that you can demonstrate in some jurisdictions. Imagine that. They don't just trust you to put it down on a sheet of paper and turn it in. You actually have to be able to demonstrate that you watched or listened. So election law blind spot is our first phrase, and we'll put another one into the show later on. Jot them down, because if you're in one of those jurisdictions, then they might actually be fact-checking you at a later date. We're going to talk a little bit more about fact-checking with Marty when we get him back, hopefully with a better connection. The other thing I wanted to mention, there he is. The other thing I wanted to mention before we jump into the video that we're going to show you in a second is Marty mentioned the show notes. We do make the show notes available. All the links we're looking at to prep the show and discuss the topics on the show are available for you to check out too at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We are right now on episode 354. So that's what you would want to go to find all the discussion points that we're using today. Marty, we've got you back. Say something. Let's see if it's better.
Hey, is this better?
I think so.
Okay.
Cue up the video. Tell us what we're going to see in this Fox News fact checking the DNC link.
So Fox, after one night of the convention, said we're going to fact check, and why don't we see how they did it?
But was the party's pitch to the voters all true? Here to set the record straight on the DNC is The Weekly Standard's John McCormick, joins us from our nation's capital. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
All right, first up, we're going to play this soundbite, then you're going to tell us if it's true or not. Here's the governor of Connecticut.
If Donald Trump's words are bad, and they are, his actions are worse. Just look at his vice presidential choice, Governor Mike Pence. He signed a law that would have forced women to hold funerals for fetuses, even in some cases after a miscarriage.
So here's a claim. Pence signed a bill that requires funerals for fetuses. And you saw the context. So, audience, form an impression. What did you take away from that claim? All right. So I tried to fact check that. Do we have the slide that's called funerals? All right. This actually ties into a point that Denise made earlier about fact-checking the era of the internet, which is that I was able to identify the bill in question fairly easily, which is not something I could have done 20 years ago. And we could make available this bill to all of you immediately if you're interested. All right, so the claim is the law requires funerals for fetuses. So I read the text of the law. What it does is that in all instances, the healthcare facility there has to be cremation or interment of the fetus after either a miscarriage or an abortion. There seems to be, in my view, two intents of the legislation. One of them is that it makes donation or for STEM research impossible. It also is part of a panoply of requirements that someone who has an abortion has to fill out forms before leaving the facility involving the cremation or interment. It says nobly that if this occurs less than 20 weeks of the life of the fetus, that the form they fill out, they do not have to put in a name. Impliedly, they may have to under other circumstances. Mm-hmm. All right. So I looked up. There's also importantly, if it's less than 20 weeks, the healthcare facility may be allowed to cremate in its ordinary course, which I'm told means multiple cremations at once. Right.
Can I also throw in, since we're guessing at the intents behind laws about dead bodies here, is we have all kinds of laws about dead bodies that don't just apply to fetuses. You can't bury grandma in the backyard. Right?
Right. Right.
We have corpse disposal rules in this country.
Agreed. All right.
Okay.
Back to the slide. All right. So I looked up what the word funeral means. It's a ceremony involving burial or cremation. Ceremony is at least two primary definitions: a ritualistic observance or procedure, a formal religious or public occasion. This certainly does, the legislation absolutely requires a procedure relating to burial or cremation. It does not require something that is ritualistic or religious. So, in my view, the law requires funerals for fetuses is false, based on a reading of the statute. On the other hand, it requires reading and context because it can be argued, and this would actually be a legal argument, as to the intent of all of these procedures in keeping with the speaker's point that the legislation impinges upon a woman's right. All right, now let's see Fox's fact check.
Before we show Fox's fact check, we do have a good question from IRC, from Omega Project there, and wondering from your reading of the statute that you found readily on the internet and fact checked, if a death certificate was involved in the process.
I can't recall whether it's a specific death certificate, but it absolutely requires a lot of documentation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, I guess the point is that in addition to a healthcare facility would have documentation requirements with regards to miscarriages and abortions. Part of this legislation is to involve the woman in filling out these forms, including having to acknowledge information, having to be shown a photograph, and so on. Now, people of good faith can argue about the intent of all of these, but also we certainly know about the effect of all of these requirements. All right, let's go ahead.
Funerals for fetuses, is that true?
It's not true. It's a lie, and a ghoulish one at that. This involved the response to this Planned Parenthood scandal that even Hillary Clinton called disturbing, whereby that organization was implicated in selling the organs of aborted babies. And this was a response to this. So not a pleasant topic to discuss, but it's a lie, and it's something that needs to be called out.
Okay. So that's a lie. What
All right.
is this?
I think that form
of fact-checking without fact-checking.
Right. So for one thing, the audience didn't get information. I sort of agree that in the context, part of the legislation absolutely is in response to stem cell research. But that is an example how fact-checking can be as much a form of advocacy as the original statement. Okay?
Right. And okay, let's tie this back into... How does fact-checking, whether it's something that is actually possible to do, I guess is one question, because your sources may always have biases that you're not aware of. I mean, unless you're going right to a law the way that you did, Marty. But then even you could see as we talked through it, how Marty was making assumptions about the intent behind the law, and I threw in another assumption, and we don't know, you know, we don't know what the lawmakers actually had in mind. That's something courts grapple with too, as they're trying to interpret statutes, is what the legislative intent was. So we have whether it's even really possible in all cases to fact check something, and then fact checking as advocacy, I think, is what you're getting at, Marty. And then how does that tie in with our discussion we were having about false advertising?
So I want to make the point, well, ultimately the point I'd like to drive home for the listeners is that you need to be an active listener. You need to think about concepts such as, am I being told a falsifiable statement? Is this puffery that I should ignore? If there's a statistic, is there some context that might render the statistic true or false? Let me give you an example. Here's the easiest case. Let's do the Loretta Lynch slide. So a meme went around, and that's really problematic because we, you know, they're anonymous. And it alleged that Loretta Lynch had worked for the Clintons, that they'd been hired during the Whitewater scandal. This turned out to be an easy one to fact check because they simply had the wrong Loretta Lynch. The Loretta Lynch, who is the AG right now, is not the Loretta Lynch who worked for the Clintons, right? So sometimes people make statistics and, you know, they're simply false. And just like the 98% pomegranate juice case, they're actually kind of rare because people tend not to tell completely black or white lies. You know, there's a category of statement that is true but misleading. Would anyone like to estimate how many police shooting deaths there have been year to date?
This year?
Yeah.
Wasn't it like around 200 or something?
Okay.
Wait, so, can I clarify? People shot by police is who you
mean?
No. No. All right. So we got to get our premises straight.
Sorry. Never mind.
That number happens to be 560.
Yes, I see. Yeah, then like 15?
Police who have been shot.
Ah.
By guns.
All right. I'm guessing it's more than 15.
All right. So
it's a dangerous job.
During Obama's speech, Trump only made one tweet. Mm-hmm. Police shooting deaths are up 78% year to date. Now that you know that, does that affect your?
Well, no, it doesn't, because I'm
an active listener. I am.
Yes, 78% of what is the question you need to ask yourself.
It went to something. Someone did a year to date. It was actually a police organization, and their year to date was July 20, so specifically for the Democrat convention. Year to date, it went from 16 to 30, which means that the five in Dallas was statistically significant.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this is an example of, as a statistical matter, without regards to that, you know, one police shooting death is too many. But mm-hmm. to the extent that this is the one statistic that's being used to make some sort of assumption about the state of the country or our safety, the numbers are simply too small for 78% increase to be meaningful. It's like batting averages in April and May that people hit 450. The numbers are too small for percentages to tell us meaningful stuff, right?
Gotcha.
That's an example of a sort of, there's this concept of true but misleading.
Mm-hmm. Fun with statistics. Always my favorite college course. Not.
Do you want to do a Hillary Clinton statistics one to show
yes,
that we're
fair and balanced?
Let's do the Hillary CEO. All right. Clinton gave a speech and she said to the world, the average CEO makes 300 times the average worker. It was in the context of saying that we don't distribute wealth as well as we should, right?
Mm-hmm.
In PolitiFact, she tends to make this sort of error often. I think she's in a rush. What she cited was a study that the top 350 CEOs make 300 times the average worker. Other studies show that 9,600 CEOs surveyed of public companies, and we don't know what percentage that is of all public companies, they make 75 times the average worker. Okay. The best we can come to the average CEO. So there's 246,000 companies that apparently have some job title that the Census Bureau characterizes as CEO. They make 4.5 times the average salary. So when Hillary Clinton says that the average CEO makes 300 times the average worker, is that a lie? What is that?
Yes.
Right.
Yes,
or
if we want to hold our candidates to higher, you know.
it's all in the details. It's all on who your CEOs
Emery,
are. I could be the CEO of my household for census purposes.
Well, they say 245,000 businesses that have something called CEO. Mm-hmm. And some don't.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a study. That's probably where she got the 300 times. Probably was in a rush. But it tells us a lot of people work for the 350 largest companies. It's not an insignificant statistic. PolitiFact called that, I think one of the other checkers did this one. They called that a pants on fire statement. Not quite sure. Oh, there we go.
That would be really, really inaccurate, I take it. Demonstrably inaccurate.
In the context, it's important, but literally, it's literally false. If mm-hmm. this was spaghetti, she'd have a Lanham Act violation.
So that's, I think, mm-hmm. an important point. Could we grade these things on whether or not you would have a Lanham Act violation? Because as much as I like the four Pinocchios and pants on fire, I think that it maybe is doing things worse. It's contributing to the narrative that politicians can just say things that are blatantly wrong and blatantly lies, and it doesn't really matter because we have a jokey term for it called pants on fire.
Well, but, I mean, that is a point that I want to – this is the point I'd like to make, that the Lanham Act and defamation law, for that matter, that teaches us – it gives us a framework for evaluating a statement. Is it falsifiable at all? Is it material to the larger point? What's being sold? If Hillary Clinton raises this issue, does that tell us something good or bad about Hillary Clinton? What are they saying? What was Ted Cruz trying to sell us on? Are we deceived into supporting Ted Cruz because of the inaccuracy of that statement? Are we deceived into supporting Hillary Clinton because of the inaccuracy of those statements? Are we deceived into supporting Donald Trump because of that, of the true but misleading nature of that statistic? I want everyone to just try to listen harder and continue to ask themselves, was this puffery, which I should disregard? I mean, there's a category of statement that is just like, when I become president, I will do the following. Talk about non-falsifiable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So as someone that has obviously thought a lot about this and false advertising in a trademark context, I mean, I think I hate to sound cynical, but I think that someone in the chat brought up earlier that asking people to critically think might be wishing on a star. Since this is just an informal discussion, what would you see? Is there any kind of regulatory solution for this? Is this something that you think the FTC should be cracking down on, or should the FEC be expanding its jurisdiction to more aggressively, monitor these kind of statements? Is there any way out of it just besides saying, everyone, you really need to be paying attention to these people because they could just be blatantly lying to you? And is that counter to the entire purpose of an election in the first place? So,
Denise, can social media help us?
Can social media help us? Well, I think so. First of all, your reaction, Emery, to the comment was far more optimistic than mine. My reaction was going back to how the courts treat puffery, which is, nobody believes it. It's not significant. It's not affecting their decisions. Everyone expects the statement on the spaghetti box that says it's America's favorite spaghetti to be false. So I think it would be equally fair to say that everyone expects our politicians to be inaccurate, unfortunately. So I think that the enforcement piece would be hard because, number one, there would be just the sheer volume of having to come down on every single statement that might contain an inaccuracy, whether it's the FTC or the FEC. And secondly, if they go through the analysis the way the courts do, they would just throw up their hands and say, yeah, people know that it's not true. So maybe that's how that would come out. But then Marty raising the social media point is a good one, because the way that people think critically and get their information is as they used to say about bloggers, when bloggers were out there watching news stories and going, hey, I know something about that area and that's just flat out wrong, and I'm going to do a blog post about it. That's sort of what we were all about as bloggers in the beginning. The motto was something like, we're going to fact check your ass. And people would get that information, maybe not as broad an audience as the original bad information, but it would start a conversation and folks would question whether the original information was valid or not. Is that what you were getting at, Marty?
Not that this is the most important thing, but it was someone at home on the internet who brought to the attention the Melania plagiarism. I don't think that's a really important point. But
I think he was a journalist in some way, shape, or form. But
definitely
not with any
picked up at some point, but I believe it might have hit the internet first on a social media network.
I think it was on Twitter.
I'm definitely a believer in this crowdsourcing model of fact-checking. Mm-hmm. Like, there's hope for that. It just seems to be our experience, at least on Twitter or something, that, you know, the as Winston Churchill said, the lie is halfway around the world by the time the truth is getting out of bed. There's, I think Winston Churchill said it much more eloquently. but it just seems that Twitter is this great mechanism for fact-checking, but also spreading misinformation. But again, we can look at the Indiana legislation, which should be an argument solver. So we have a platform for greater fact-checking and the dissemination of experts checking facts. So there, I'm hopeful in that regard. With regards to what Emery asked about legislation, you know, culturally, we're very reluctant to interfere in any meaningful way in political speech during a campaign. So, you know, there are some cases. It's sort of interesting. So, for example, in political speech or non-commercial speech, there was like a Vietnam vet organization, and they hire a telemarketing company to solicit donations on its behalf. Turns out that the telemarketing organization would keep 85% of the donations. The vets would only get 15%. So the Illinois AG goes after the telemarketing company. So it goes up to the Supreme Court. It's like Illinois versus Telemarketing Associates, I want to say 2003 maybe, Supreme Court case. Court says, this is fraud. Illinois is allowed to enforce fraud. Saying, please give me a dollar and not disclosing that you're basically only going to give 15 cents to the target is fraud. Had Illinois said a law, charities have to devote X percent of their donations to this and not to that, that would be a prior restraint on speech. So, which seems crazy that the state cannot regulate that in a way. But that shows you how protective we are of what we deem to be non-commercial speech. So, in other words, I think the market has to do the policing. Because of the First Amendment, we're going to stay away from regulation on these Ted Cruz commercials and all of these ads.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Just so I fact checked us to determine who the person was who broke the Melania Trump story. And my recollection was correct. He's a freelance journalist. His name is Jarrett Hill, and he did an interview with Vox by Alicia Brown, interviewed him there, where he describes how he was sitting in a California Starbucks the night of the speech, watching a live stream, and realized the words were very familiar to him. Kudos to him for hearkening back to a speech several years ago and recognizing that he was hearing that same phraseology again. I don't know that very many people could pull that off. So eidetic memory is a good, I guess, trait to have as a freelance journalist. Hopefully it will help Jarrett Hill out. Because it makes your point, though, Marty, that people tend to, when they recognize something doesn't feel right about what they're watching, and they're pretty confident about it, they'll put it out there and let other people figure things out. And that's what Jarrett Hill did here. He first said, oh my gosh, I think that whole, he said that was literally a whole line from Michelle Obama 2012. And then he went through and found, you know, he found the speech the way you found the law in question before. And he found that there was actually even more than one line that was familiar to that other speech. So fascinating that that's how that came out. And I, again, I'm so impressed. I watched Hillary Clinton's speech last night, and the only sort of insightful thing that I was tempted to tweet but refrained from doing it, I did see that other people tweeted it though, was, poor Hillary, someone please get her a lozenge. She's clearing her throat all the time. She has a bad sore throat and has to give this speech. So unfortunately, I didn't have anything more newsworthy to offer than that, so I didn't even put it out there. Getting back to Melania Trump though, and stuff in your wheelhouse, Marty. Our missing co-host, Mike Keyes, did an article that I actually, it's behind a paywall, so I don't have the whole thing where he fleshes this out in a bit more detail. He did also post on their firm blog, which is the TMCA.com, about Melania's RNC speech, plagiarism, copyright infringement, or both. And of course, there's been all kinds of, you can check out Mike's piece to see about the plagiarism and copyright aspects. But for you, Marty, in his other piece, he also raised this trademark idea that perhaps this could be a false endorsement. Is that something that you can expand on for us, as we don't have Mike here to explain his thoughts?
He really said that, huh?
He really said that, yeah. And I was thinking maybe you could get into his head better than I did. We'll have to ask him when he gets back.
It won't be fair, because off the top of my head, there's a Supreme Court case called Daystar, which kind of says don't try to take a weak copyright infringement claim and make it a trademark claim. So no, usually... showing somebody else's words and palming them off as yours, that should be the proper province of copyright, not trademark. So Daystar, D-A-S-T-A-R, had to do with an old war television show. So that's my, my initial impression is no, but I haven't read his article, so it's not really fair.
Yeah, I haven't even asked me to send us a copy of his article yet from behind the paywall. So I'll do that, and we'll see what he has to say about whether... both copyright law and trademark law might be implicated by having a very similar speech to another first lady. What other points here do we have in our false advertising / election segment of the rundown that we should hit? Do you want to talk more, Marty, about the Hill article that we showed, false advertising law as a weapon against political action committees?
It's really interesting. Again, it's going to be a limit to competitors. And there may be various reasons why you don't want to sue the other politician during a race. But I'm thinking that maybe a PAC should be formed that could really have standing to go after some of these things. It is very disturbing. I mean, we may be getting a little bit too far afield, but there are permanent fundraising activities. You know, I was on Facebook, and it was like maybe February 2015. One of the controversial Supreme Court cases had come out about, might have been the gay marriage decision, I'm not sure. And I get a promoted ad on Facebook for the Texas Attorney General. And it says, you know, if you want to fight this, then click here. And it goes to his permanent donation page. And I'd not heard of this guy, so look him up. He had just entered office. So his next election won't be for 3 years and 10 months. And he's – my math was wrong, but he's soliciting donations. And I'm thinking that's a little bit exploitative for a state AG to ask for money based on based on a political goal. He's supposed to be doing this, you know, he gets a salary, right? And I don't want to single him out. I then looked up New York's AG has a perpetual donation page. Illinois' AG has a perpetual donation page. But there's a problem of 24-hour, 365 solicitation by candidates and PACs. And I will just quote somebody else. I'll quote Josh Marshall at Talking Points Memo and say that I have not fact-checked him. But his thesis is that Ben Carson's campaign as an entirety was a multi-level marketing scam, that that it's all about soliciting money in exchange for the I will fight for your political goals if you give me money. So how do you breach that agreement? but yes, there's a need to there is fraud in the PAC market, and it's hard to police because of respect for the First Amendment.
Right. We have another story in the rundown. Again, most of the time when we're talking about use of music during the campaigns, it comes up either because a particular work wasn't licensed and the artist or other rights holders come after the campaign and, you know, say we didn't authorize that, either, you know, stop playing it or license it or what have you. But there was a piece in the Hollywood Reporter that again raised the Lanham Act in sort of a false endorsement context because of the problematic thing for the musician if they don't agree politically with whoever's using their song, that it sounds to the audience like they are endorsing that politician. I don't think anybody, you know, would have any confusion about Katy Perry if they watched the Democratic convention. She was there, she sang, her music was all over it. And, you know, I don't think there's any possible issue there, but there might be, and there have in the past been politicians or been musicians who used copyright because that was the maybe more appropriate vehicle for them to wield to say, hey, you can't use that track without permission. But really, where their sensibilities were offended were they did not want to be affiliated with or thought to be endorsing that politician. Is that a closer fit for the Lanham Act, Marty?
So I think it's a hard, well, you set out the facts pretty well, Denise. If you see Katy Perry, it's just, she's performing live. I mean, it's so obvious from the context, right? The TechDirt article that you linked to, I'm afraid, was a little bit imprecise. They make the point that venues, respectable venues like conventions, convention halls, are going to take some kind of collective license from the collective licensing societies, BMI and ASCAP, which under normal circumstances would allow that venue to play the music. What the article didn't really deal with is that these licenses may have carve-outs. So in other words, if you have a national convention for the first time ever, that might not be in your regular license. So it may not be the case that, you know, Queen, that the Quicken Arena was allowed to play the Queen song, and that would be covered under its normal license. The fact that it's being broadcast on television will also probably change the terms of the license. So the arena may have breached license if they allow this music to be played when they know it's being recorded, right? Mm-hmm. I've kind of wondered when sometimes I watch a basketball game and the crowd starts singing along to Seven Nation Army, whether that counts as a live performance that is going to require a sync license. That was subtle copyright lawyer humor.
I've got a quick question on sync licenses, and this is something I was concerned about when you just brought that up. I understand that sync licenses are a type of mandatory license that creators, you know, are forced to provide, at least for like cover songs. But is there any negotiation in the terms of those licenses? Do they have the ability to ask BMI or ASCAP to include in their mandatory licenses provisions that, for example, prevent their music from being played at political events?
So I don't think this falls under a compulsory license situation.
Okay.
Especially a live performance or a television performance. Okay. But I guess the point is, just as a very technical copyright issue, these arena licenses with the collective societies very often will be specific. There'll be specific situations that are carved out. Okay. Now, again, some of the things occur at rallies that are not held in public facilities. That was another issue I had with the article, which is that some of these complaints have been at rallies at venues like airport hangars that tend not to have collective society licenses. So, but to talk to Denise's point, if you go to a political rally and they play some song, it's going to depend on the context as to whether you may form a erroneous conclusion as to the association between the singer and the performer. So I'm going to take the easy way out and say that it's fact specific.
It depends.
Right. Right. I think that people who knew anything about Freddie Mercury might have a hard time thinking that Queen and or the estate of Mercury would be as behind Trump as one might think if they were just going by how often "We Are the Champions" is played at Trump events.
I think John Oliver's joke was Freddie Mercury dies again at the age of 69.
Oh, bad, bad, bad joke. Speaking of television personalities and the law, I think, unless Marty, is there anything else under election law or trademark? Yeah, let's go to Colbert. Yeah. So let's go to Hollywood and talk about Colbert. Okay, for anyone who has not been paying attention to what happened here, Marty, can you please explain what is going on with Stephen Colbert and the character he created and made famous at Comedy Central?
This one hurts my head to think about, so I'm going to talk really slowly, okay?
Yes.
All right. Colbert performed a character on The Daily Show, which would be owned by Comedy Central. It was a satirical show, and a character can be the subject of copyright. And this is not a new concept. There was a case in the 30s, I think, that involved Sam Spade, the protectability. So the reason why you would not be able to write a Harry Potter novel yourself, in which Harry Potter is a character, and even if you avoided the trademark problems, made it clear who it's from, the character of Harry Potter is protected by copyright. So Colbert played a character on The Daily Show and then developed the character in The Colbert Report. What hurts one's head, what is that it's hard to articulate what is the limits of, what are the elements of that copyrighted character? If we were talking about Sherlock Holmes, okay, he has a hat and he has a pipe and he's a morphine addict and he talks in a certain way and so on. It's hard to articulate what is the copyrightable elements of Stephen Colbert's character on The Colbert Report, because he's named Stephen Colbert and looks a lot like Stephen Colbert, so that cannot be part of what is copyrightable. All right.
How about things like, and again, this sort of maybe goes more
to the eyebrow.
Trademark, things like the word truthiness, okay, or things like the word, you know, and that's the word, the things that he incorporated as common themes that would come back in the show. Could that be part of the copyrighted character?
That's the easy part of articulating what part of the copyright, the written elements, that gets more specific. And as we get farther away from character, it's easier to define. All right. So now as we all know, Colbert goes to a different entity, CBS, and that which is copyrightable at the old show remains the property of Comedy Central. So last week, Colbert has a bit where he reintroduces the old Stephen Colbert as a character and does a skit called The Word and talks about Trumpiness. Mm-hmm. Comedy Central sends a demand letter, we are told. And because you really should not, not only should you not pick a fight with people who buy ink by the barrel, you should not pick a fight with people who have access to a late night TV show. So Colbert introduces Stephen Colbert, the twin cousin of Stephen Colbert. Right? And there's a very funny bit. Hopefully we provided links so you guys can see last week's bit and this week's bit. Because
yes,
quite
they're
funny.
All in the discussion points.
As to what a twin cousin might be. This is my analysis. Stephen Colbert, the twin cousin, is a parody, a protectable parody, a non-infringing parody. Mm-hmm. Of Stephen Colbert, the reporter, who's the property of Comedy Central. Now, here's some irony for you. Stephen Colbert, the reporter, is himself a satire of people like Bill O'Reilly. Mm-hmm. So, as a joke on the blog, I said, the irony being that the part of Colbert, the reporter's character that's protectable actually belongs to Bill O'Reilly. In any event, this is a parody of a satire, and that's why it makes my head spin.
Yes.
Ah, there you have it. That is Stephen Colbert, the cousin.
I guess I'm not really sure on the parody bit. My understanding of parody was that the joke of the parody had to be referencing the original thing that it is parodying, sort of like related to satire. And that, you know, it's not a satire unless it's the crux of it is talking about the heart of the original issue. Is this a parody? Because as I understood it, when I was watching the bit, it looked like he was just using the character to make the same points that he would have made as the character before. It was not like he was like, yes, there was a part. The intro of the bit was talking about, you know, the joke was that this was his, you know, identical twin cousin. And, you know, for that, like, short 30-second introduction, I could see that, you know, his character of Stephen Colbert, the twin cousin, is a parody of Stephen Colbert, the character on Comedy Central. But from that point forward, I would imagine that the copyright and like the infringement argument has is much stronger. What do you think of that? I mean, is there like a substantial similarity analysis that needs to be made, or am I off base?
You're not off base because you articulated the rule. The parody must refer to a subject. As they say, enough to remind you of the subject, but not too much that you confuse. So mm-hmm. Are you confused as to who is Colbert the cousin? I mean, I think Colbert the cousin is clearly referring to Colbert the reporter, and you understand it as such. If this was a regular feature and they always did The Word, and that mm-hmm. was another joke, that The Word is just like The Word except with an E. If they were to make this guy a regular character and they did The Word each week, they'd probably be asking for a lawsuit. But under mm-hmm. this circumstance, at least the thing that was on this week. All right, so here's the original, The Word. Mm-hmm. But this week's segment with Word with an A, it mm-hmm. clearly is parodying this mm. without confusion, right?
Yeah.
Again, if they did this an ongoing thing, then people would stop laughing and they'd say that's copyright infringement because, I mean, it's clear that the intellectual property that surrounds a segment about words called The Word, that they've copied that. I know that Denise has spoken often about the parody satire distinction. I don't think anybody's happy with it. But I think we want Colbert to be able to make segments like he did this week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And And probably, as you say, Marty, it would offend someone's sensibilities if then, you know, in hosting The Tonight Show, this became a staple the way it was on his other show without some sort of compensation to Comedy Central. So,
right.
Let's do just one more story before we get to our closing materials for the day. Let's look at, since this has been much in the news this week, the DNC hack and its aftermath. I'm not bringing it up in the context of the security details, which is something that I'm sure Steve Gibson can tell you much more about and that you'd much rather hear from Steve Gibson about. I bring it up in the context of the editorial that you spotted, Emery, at Ars Technica by Dave Itell there, captioned that the DNC hack and dump is what cyber war looks like. Which I think is an excellent point. Is there anything you want to pull out from this editorial that particularly resonated with you?
I don't really know if I can pull out any cogent points from it. I think it's an interesting read. I think that provided that the narrative that this leak was sourced from some Russian state-sponsored hacker, the conversation is one that's certainly one worthy to be had. I think that, yes, if that was the case, then this is cyber war. And what does that mean? I would push back strongly against Dave Itell's statement that, you know, this needs to be met with an equal or greater response. We need to be escalating this, or it reflects poorly, or, you know, shows our weakness on our cyber war front. I'm not sure if I buy the narrative that it's a Russian state-sponsored hacker. I wish I had a more cogent point. I wanted to introduce it to the rest of the team.
Right. Well, thank you for bringing it up, because the other thing it sort of platforms us into, which goes very well with whether someone is doing parody or satire or sarcasm, is the response at Donald Trump's press conference. Where he and I've gotten emails from listeners going, wait a minute, can he do this? It seems like incitement or collusion or otherwise some sort of criminal act if you are actually inviting a foreign government to hack a person or entity in the United States, which I think is a good point. But I think, you know, much of what we've been discussing today, I don't think in a million years it would be prosecuted as such. And I think, Marty, you and I are of different opinions as to whether it was clear from the context that the comment was sarcastic, as Donald Trump now says that it was intended. When you saw it, Marty, you thought it was sarcastic. You came away like Katy Perry at the DNC. She's clearly endorsing Hillary Clinton. Did you think it was that crystal clear that he clearly did not intend for the Russian government to, or I believe it was the Russians he specifically invited, to attempt to get at the 33,000 missing emails?
So do we have the clip?
I didn't give it to Victor before the show. Maybe he can pull it up while we're talking.
Yeah. You know, as much as I'd like to pin everything on him, a legal analysis, which is, what was the speaker's reasonable intent? What is someone listening to the speech's reasonable understanding of what's going on? You know, we have some laws about, it said that you can't joke about killing the president, and you can't joke about having a bomb on an airplane. And that's not exactly either of those statutes. It's really about you can't make a statement where people listening to you will come away with this reasonable interpretation. So I don't really think that Trump, well, you know, in the age of dog whistle, we don't know what the speaker reasonably thinks the listeners will have, but whether a Russian hacker reasonably thinks that Trump wants them to do it. Well, now that I say it, maybe I'm going to contradict myself. Maybe he did reasonably think that some hackers are going to do it, but I don't think Putin hears that and goes, okay, I should put the government on this. Denise also points out that maybe as a New Yorker, I kind of understood his sarcasm more, or at least was sensitive to it. It shows the problem. I mean, unless we can do an MRI on the guy, I don't know what he was thinking. And unless we can do an MRI on the guys who are hearing it, I don't know what they're thinking. It's the criticism of the remark, I think, is not a legal one.
Right. But that did at least occur to some of our listeners. Oh, here we go. Let's listen.
Email hacking problem. Let's listen in.
Women, by the way, if I ever said the things that are on those emails, I would have been run out of town, and probably had I gotten the nomination,
this isn't it, actually, Victor.
No.
He's giving a speech. The clip in question is from his press conference the other day.
But as long as we're talking, it's a good example of non-falsifiable statements that politicians use the subjunctive tone to avoid. If this fictitious thing had happened, then I'm going to say the following unfactually supported consequence of that.
Makes me think we need some kind of Chrome app or Firefox plugin that can just automatically tag every single time there's a unverifiable statement that you read. I think it would be an interesting thing.
It would be going off all the time. You'd never get any work.
Yeah.
Bing, bing, bing. Yeah, the reason I do think we were having our West Coast, East Coast biases showing, Marty, and you assuming it was sarcasm and me assuming he was sincere. The other bit that doesn't get played as much as the part I've seen played over and over again on the news, the part where he's saying, you know, I think it'd be very interesting if you could get at the 33,000 emails. The part he says right before that is he's being questioned about actually in some way collaborating with Russia on the hack, not the 33,000 emails, the hack that led to the embarrassing emails about Bernie Sanders and the campaign's approach toward him. His statement there was, no, I don't have that kind of power. I'd love to have that power. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that seemed like a very sincere statement at that juncture in time. That seemed like an excited utterance almost, as we would use in the law, admissible in court.
Well,
all right.
You know,
go ahead.
There's a lot of statutes that require, they ask into the intent. And for example, trademark infringement. Did the person do this intentionally? And they don't impose a when asking good faith, they don't impose an actual statement or intent. It's like constructive. In other words, it's so easy to testify that you held a certain belief that we can't even rely on the person's testimony. So in other words, Trump says these things, and then 3 days later he says, "I was joking." And if this was a point to be proven, we'd say, we're not even going to credit your testimony. We're going to look at the circumstances under which you said it. And could someone reasonably interpret what you said as not being a joke, for example? So, I mean, it's because of the ease with which one can lie about their intent that we don't go by that as the standard.
Right. And I think with all of that said and done, we need to make "just kidding" our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We'll go on right now, because I know you've been waiting for it for the entire show, to our animal selfie of the week. We have an animal selfie of the week for you and some animal selfie news. Our selfie itself is a giant seagull at Hampton Beach. This was taken by the Hampton Beach camera mounted by WMUR-TV. The seagull is obviously not as giant as it appears. This is a matter of perspective. And again, one could go into the discussion of whether PETA might step in and represent this seagull, because I believe that the seagull here, I don't know exactly how WMUR-TV's camera operates. It might be motion operated, but I'm guessing it's just pointed at that lovely beach all the time. And if a seagull were to get in front of it, it's an accidental selfie in that case. But I liked the seagull. It was a lovely image of him or her.
It was great composition.
Yes, great composition. And then the animal selfie news is that PETA's appeal from the Naruto case, which it lost, where it tried to assert copyrights on behalf of Naruto the macaque, the selfie-taking monkey, is still pending before the Ninth Circuit. There's an appellate brief that you can read there if you would are so inclined, submitted by the illustrious firm of Urell and Manella up the road from me here in Los Angeles. So that appeal still continues. And someone dropped that link into the rundown. Did either of you want to say more about the appeal? What did you want to add, Emery?
Yeah, I mean, I know it would be remiss if we were to have another episode of This Week in Law and not bring up the selfie monkey that started it all. So, of course, I wanted to let our listeners know about that. But, you know, I love Mike Masnick. I love his writing. And he just tore into PETA in their argument in this article. Very entertaining read. But, you know, I think that maybe I have to dig down a little deeper, but I find some of the arguments that the PETA lawyer is pushing, if not convincing today, certainly interesting to think about in the context, not just of animal selfies, but of, you know, we talk sometimes about algorithms and AIs creating art and writing papers. You know, the arguments that the PETA lawyer is pushing forward is saying that, look, there's nowhere in the Copyright Act that says that this has to be a human. The focus is more on the originality of the work. Mike Masnick, of course, pushes back against that and, you know, pushes the idea that, no, you're wrong. Copyright, like, you know, intellectual property in America are really economic incentives. You know, and obviously a monkey has no idea about copyright. And so that, you know, to say that the focus should be on the originality of the work is ridiculous. You know, I just had an interesting conversation with my patent law professor yesterday about the sort of distinction there of whether intellectual property rights are property rights or economic incentives. And so, you know, if you're interested in the legal weeds, if you want to, you know, dig down into an issue a little deeper, the monkey selfie continues to provide, you know, some good stuff.
Yeah, little known fact about that seagull is its very impressive patent portfolio.
And I will say that if there's ever a legal hackathon, I call dibs on making the animal triggered treat providing camera.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's awesome. Our tip of the week we've been giving you throughout the whole show, and that is that especially it at this time of our history and at this time of the year in an election year, to think critically about what you're hearing, whether it's online or on TV or in any other form, and to have the tools at hand to help you do that even more fully, always bearing in mind, too, that, you know, it all goes back to the data and the biases that may be in the data that are going into the fact checking that you might be engaged in. So Marty had some great fact checked resources to go along with that tip. You want to tell us about fact checking Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump's greatest hits, Marty?
In the show notes, you will see URLs for factcheck.org and PolitiFact, two of the more prominent fact checkers. They have lots and lots of statements that they fact check, and they tell you how they come by their conclusions. They have tables by individual candidates, and this week they have Donald Trump's greatest hits and Hillary Clinton's greatest hits, which I think accumulates the most egregiously wrong statements of both of them. There is another URL in the show notes. The fellow who put together the bar graph of PolitiFact, and for some reason there they have the methodology that PolitiFact uses for their fact-checking. I just wanted to add one thing, though, about the PETA monkey selfie thing that it's very disturbing, because I actually have been accumulating an infinite number of monkeys at an infinite number of typewriters in the hopes that they would write Hamlet. And if you tell me that I won't not be able to claim copyright, then what was the point?
That's true. That's true. I think maybe you need to submit an amicus brief to the Ninth Circuit. Get that argument in front of them before they make any wrong decisions. There we go. Yep. Absolutely. So, yes, additional resources of the week for you are the Political TV Ad Archive and the New Republic TV Ad Archive. If you ever, you know, remember that somebody said something in an ad and you want to see exactly what they said verbatim, odds are you might find them there. Those are also in our discussion points. Thanks again, Marty. And one other resource for you, or just something to put on your calendar if you're interested in this sort of thing, coming up in September, on September 15th, 2016, the FTC is putting on an event called Putting Disclosures to the Test. To examine the testing and evaluation of disclosures that companies make to consumers about advertising claims, privacy practices, and other information. So if you're interested in that, interested in following what occurs at that event, we just wanted to highlight it for you. It's coming up on September 15th in Washington, D.C. And with that, this has been a really fun, really interesting deep dive into how we think about the information we get from all of our sources. And my head is okay. I don't think it's hurting as bad as Hillary Clinton's throat was last night. So I'm in pretty good shape. And I really appreciate you guys joining me. Marty, so good to see you again.
It's good to be seen.
Anything you want to let us know about in your practice or in White Plains that folks might want to be aware of before we sign off today?
Why don't we just say, we'll put in the usual plug. The Twitter handle is @trademarkblog, and we'll leave it at that.
All right, cool. Wonderful to see you again, Marty. And take care. And I'm sure your schedule permitting, we will have you back on very soon.
Thank you very much.
Emery, great chatting with you again, too.
Yep. Thanks for having me. As always, this has been a blast. Listeners, tune in next week. I think Denise might be out of town, but myself and Mike will be solo hosting the show, or co-hosting the show in her stead. So very nervous. Yes. And exciting times ahead.
I know. I'm going to be actually quite excited to watch that show. I know you guys are going to do an awesome job co-hosting. But joining you will also be Colette Vogel, another old, longtime recurring guest, friend of the show, and Franklin Graves, who, like Emery, was once an Emery. No, but he was an intern at This Week in Law, and such a great guy, and he's now a practicing lawyer, and he is going to join us as well next week. So do tune in, stay tuned for that great show when you get a chance next week. And it will happen, as all of our shows do, at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC on a Friday. That's when we record the show. It's our regular time slot. So if you like joining us live, please do tune in then. You can jump into IRC with us at irc.twit.tv. But do not worry if that doesn't work for your schedule. Just don't worry about it at all. Go to twit.tv/twill, because our whole archive of shows is there. You can watch them on your own time, on whatever device you prefer, on whatever platform you prefer. You can watch it right there at our twit.tv site. You can watch it on YouTube. You can use iTunes if that is your cup of tea. You can use Roku if that is as well. So just, you know, however, whenever, wherever you can join us, we're thrilled that you do. Please continue doing so. Please continue getting in touch with us between the shows. We love hearing from you, your insights, tips, analyses, suggestions, all of that. Email is a great way to do that. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Emery is Emery at twit.tv. Mike is Mike at twit.tv. See how logically we did all that. I'm not sure who had the little beeping going on in the show this week, but I don't think it was Pokemon Go. I think we've all kind of recovered. It was not Emery. Emery has an air conditioning unit that I am quite jealous of right now, that I may have to slip in, you know, to my own little window here in my office, because we have no AC and Southern California is sweltering right now. I know. Marty, you're in New York, and I know it's worse there.
In some regards, yes.
Heat and humidity-wise, it's worse there. So definitely do get in touch with us. Hit us up on Twitter. Send us messages there. That's a great way to go. If you have more to say than that, again, use the email or find us on Facebook or Google Plus. The show has pages on both those platforms. And we'd love to hear from you however it works best for you. Thanks so much for joining us, and we will see you next week. The boys and Colette will see you next week. I will see you 2 weeks from now on This Week in Law.